Good evening. This is the second term of our series of lectures joint with the Royal Academy of Arts, which is looking at London, contemporary London, and indeed London of the immediate future. And what we've been doing during the first term is looking at projects of very different scales, from urban master planning with King's Cross to the tall buildings of the Eastern Cluster, down to the public realm that Richard McCormack is proposing for the Victoria Embankment. This term, we're going to have a complementary set of lectures which look at buildings and public works of similar scales. And sort of back-to-back with Richard McCormack's lecture, we have this evening Neil Porter of Gustafson Porter, who's going to be talking about the Diana Memorial in Hyde Park, something that every one of you will know something about, will have an opinion about, I'm very sure. Whether it's a well-informed opinion, we shall see as the lecture proceeds. Neil Porter is a director of Gustafson Porter. The practice was formed in 1997. He's an architect, and I think it's intriguing that an architect and his partner, who comes from a background of fashion design and art, have combined to create something which is very, very potent in terms of its symbolism. So Neil has very wisely decided not to talk too much about the symbolism, but to on the basis that people may well ask questions about that at the end, but really to talk about their reading of or the process that they went through to actually produce this work. So please welcome Neil Porter.
I'm relieved it's a small lecture hall and without too many people clamoring to hear what I have to say. It was with some trepidation that I decided that I would talk about the Diana Memorial. As has been intimated, a lot of people know a lot about it in different ways. And of course, there's the memorial that opened in June of 2004. And all the media coverage that have given a lot of people an impression of what it is and what they may see if they go and visit the site. But there's also the memorial that's recently opened this year, which has not really hit the headlines, and as much as we would like it, it had 600,000 visitors over the summer, and we hope that this will continue quietly and enjoyably for everybody who goes. Oops, good start. Okay. So this is the scene, the place that Catherine and I, on one rather wet, wintry day, walked across the Serpentine Bridge to the site, and were curious as to what one really should do in a place like this. We'd been attracted to the project because, of course, it's in Hyde Park and we're landscape designers. And, you know, it was really about, for us, how do you place a memorial to a very well-known person in such a context? We decided that we didn't want the memorial to be a rather solemn affair, and really felt that day, in the rather gloomy circumstances of the weather that surrounded us, that something joyful and reflective was the way to go. We certainly, at that time, didn't expect headlines like this. And this was the day after the opening. We had this sort of amazing sunny weather, and certainly it's really interesting seeing how the media sort of projected it. It was obviously mixed, and this is probably one of the worst of the headlines. And without doubt, one has to sort of remember that, you know, the memorial exists because of Diana. Its impact is because of Diana. It owes its character and existence to her. And so its rather colourful life since then means that, you know, her name is carried forward through anything that happens there. And this is not really an excuse, but I think somehow the memorial's arrival allowed the media to keep her in the headlines. There are many other stories that keep her in the headlines. But we have to see it at that level. Until that moment, I don't think many people knew about Catherine or myself or Gustav Sinporta. We were known amongst a rather small community of designers and clients. And we have a much larger body of work that still people aren't really aware of. And most of that work does incorporate water. Water is one of the main themes elements of landscape. And not to use it would be a huge pity. And so here, one of Catherine's past schemes, the Jardin Imaginaire and Terrasson, you can see how water is harnessed through the use of natural springs on a very beautiful hillside in the south of France to create a completely watery environment. Again, a project of Catherine's in a town square just outside Paris, the Square of Human Rights, Evry. Here, water takes center stage. It occupies the site when the square is empty, to close down and be used for other purposes when civic need require it. Ross Terrace, New York, a fantastic water feature, a sort of constellation of jets that at night mirror the night sky in front of the new planetarium. Closer to home, Gustav Sinporta's project for the Treasury West Courtyard, where a very tight enclosed space uses water to create a sense of space. It also allows for the facade of the building to be reflected into a contemporary garden landscape. The East Courtyard does something else. It creates a ring of water acting as a threshold to people's arrival into the garden, distancing them from their office work. The Vesta Gas Fabrique, much larger scale water feature, a big lake that acts as the main draw for people arriving in the park, that then, if they follow its route, allows them to pass into a series of water terraces and stream gardens. So one has to see the Diana Memorial in that context. It's one of many projects. We won the competition after a long wait. And the simple ring of water was, in a way, I think, misinterpreted from the very start. The necklace of stone that we had wanted to rest lightly on the landform that supported it was seen in all sorts of ways as a ditch, a moat, a sewer. We had all the various sort of water services used as a description. The undulating landform and ring itself was given a conceptual title, Reaching Out, Letting In. It described several qualities we wished to achieve. It reflected Diana's relationship to us as the public. She reached out to affect those around her, but she was also vulnerable and affected by what she let in. So the memorial was a circular form that reached out in all directions. and allowed those who entered it to be enveloped by a total landscape mood or environment. So, to build this, there was a big debate about the stone, and of course, it had to be British. Here is the quarry yard at Delanc and Bodmin Moor. Stone is a very difficult material to engineer. It's a very traditional material, and we were up against a very short deadline. I think this is something that has escaped the press. I think from the moment we began seriously designing the project to the moment it opened, we had no more than 18 months. And we had an extraordinarily complex 3D form to generate on computers, and then actually carve somehow. Traditionally, this would have been made up of, in terms of drawings, reams of sections. And then a whole army of masons would have needed to spend a lot of time chiseling out the form. So we had some problems ahead of us. And I think this is one of the sort of untold stories of the project. Before the sheer enormity of the task ahead of us sort of really descended on the office, we worked, as we always do, Catherine and I, sometimes Catherine, sometimes I, but in this case both of us, on a clay model. This defined its basic three-dimensional form. You can see from the lower slide that it starts in a rather crude way. We place a series of givens, the trees in this instance, as a features of the existing landscape that couldn't be changed, and then worked over time, I think a week, to develop the form in that context. At the same time, we were also curious as to what 3D architectural computer-aided design packages would allow us to do. We knew that it had to be an extremely malleable system. And we tested out, checked out a whole series of packages. None allowed us to sort of just tweak the form like a piece of plastic to ensure that we got a constantly flowing three-dimensional form. And we really did begin to scratch our heads as to how quickly we were going to be able to produce the information needed. And this is when a series of good fortune sort of came our way. Through John Gould of Baron Gould, we discovered SDE, Surface Design Engineering. They worked in the motor industry using a system called IsomSurf. This allowed for a much more malleable, easily worked form. We could just push in, stretch out, twist as we wished, obviously with them operating. And it was through this process that I became, in car industry language, the stylist, and SDE created the jelly mold. And this image basically describes the checks that they used to ensure that the memorial had a completely smooth curvature and allowed for the water to constantly flow in a downward direction. But they also helped with sectioning up the jelly mold and creating the basic cut forms of the memorial. Whilst SDE were working on the ring, John Gould, an industrial designer who's I'd worked with in the past, had been working on 3D texturing on materials used mainly, I think, for home use or interior use, and had called up and said he thought he had the answer to some of those issues surrounding the creation of texture in the surface of the memorial. Up till that point, we had known that we wanted it. We knew that masons could achieve it, but we didn't know how to translate our thoughts, our feelings about how it should be easily into the scheme. So John was extraordinarily helpful, and we soon found that with his help, we were able to generate a whole series of textures and lay them into the surface of the jelly mold. The textures are a really interesting process that we worked with him on. We had sort of had this idea that somehow the ring of water should develop and change character as water moved down the slope, as it got older, as it moved away from the source. So at the top of the screen, you see a very sort of smooth area where the water bubbles up out of the ground, or seemingly so. And then in two directions it flows, one to my side, down a sort of turbulent, babbling brook, and then through sort of a series of effervescent effects that then lead the water over the cascade at the bottom. There's a pointer here. So we've got the babbling brook, sort of the effervescent stream, the chadder, which is a Muslim Mughal term for a cascade using very little water, down to a pool at the bottom. And then at the top, another run of water, a stepped cascade, which works into a sort of rock and roll feature that becomes what we call the swoosh, where the water turns over before reaching the pool. And the result of John's work, which was to really explore how from a 2D image of a texture that we felt appropriate and that might work with water, the contrast between light and dark could be interpreted into a three-dimensional form. And that could then just get placed over the information that SDE were creating for the stonemasons to form the textures on each of the stones. Our next surprise. We hadn't really anticipated that the stone industry really in this country is based in the past. And the big machines that are used in the quarries of Italy, China, Germany are few and far between. John, again, saved us. He did the research, found that there were four companies in Britain that had the CNC machines. Organized for us to see the most likely, McConnell's, and we flew out to Northern Ireland, the mountains of Mourne, to find ourselves in this farmyard. They were the only company that were willing to invest in buying two new machines that were going to be kept running 24 hours a day to create the material needed. By this time, we were down to less than a year before the opening. The techniques used, translated from the CNC, technology the SDE were working on, IsomSurf, was translated into CNC language. And the result was a whole series of sawn pieces of stone, the basic forms of the memorial, with its natural anti-slip texturing. This was the simple bit, the most least time-consuming, most cost-effective. The texturing could also be sawn, much smaller diameter saws, and the result was that we got relatively intricate patterning and texture, which in this case, the stepped cascade, created rivulets of water as it passes down the slope. All this material was cut, put together in the workshops in Northern Ireland before being sent to site. Our bigger problem was the texturing on the bubbling brook. Here and on the Chadder, we had a much more serious problem. The tools used were very vulnerable. They couldn't cut huge amounts of stone at one moment. And within hours, we were finding that they would get worn down. And it would have required hundreds of these tools to create the textures we wanted. So again, we had to sort of put heads together. And in the bottom right hand, is that right? From your direction, bottom right hand corner, you've got our solution. It was a really simple sort of rethinking of the normal methods of cutting the stone. Here we used terracing like contours. So slowly the bits would drill into the stone layer by layer, millimetre by millimetre, taking more of the stone out of the surface of the form, and created the textures that would then become, in my view, some of the most sort of interesting and intriguing. Here you can see the texture of as a two-dimensional surface translated into three-dimensional form. Oops, sorry. And again, incredibly complex surfaces were created. I think this is one of the sort of unknown impacts of this project. In the future, stonemasons with those machines will be able to create this type of texturing in a much more free-form manner than they've ever been able to do before. And this goes across every part of the industry. I think they haven't yet realized what they have available to them. So at the same time, we were having our stone crises, ensuring that we had the material ready for site. Work was continuing on the project. The ring of concrete required for the foundation was laid. First stones started to arrive, all with their labels, the XYZ coordinates, so that each stone, rather like a huge jigsaw puzzle, would have an absolute precise place and space and on the site. Imperial College tested aspects of the water using polystyrene foam from the jelly mould forms in a reduced scale. And it was all this type of sort of issue that had to be fine-tuned. And Mary from our office has spent a lot of time to-ing and fro-ing between the various fountain specialists, Arup, the engineers, the contractor, ensuring that all the pieces fitted together. Here, before the opening, you can see it was with huge relief, in fact, that the water was switched on. And the memorial or the ring of water came into being. There was always that sort of last minute fear that water would sort of escape, shoot off one corner of the oval. This is the stepped cascade and turbulent stream. The effervescent water, the babbling brook. The sort of gliding stream, the swoosh, the Chadder, and the pool at the base of the slope. The whole memorial was sort of positioned in such a way that when you came upon it in the landscape, you would come across a feature from one of the stronger sort of roots into the site. And that, having come across it, you would start moving around it over a bridge and then in a very relaxed way into the center of the site. We gave it a slightly, gave it a strong orientation, the shaded side away from the Serpentine on the top of the slope, the sunny side with a view to the Serpentine at the base. So the dash to complete the memorial on time meant that the planted landscape was completed only just before the opening. The turf was fresh and various teething problems waited to be revealed. The first, as you will know, the TV screens showed a wonderful ceremony broadcast to millions of people. So what started as a regal stroll around the memorial by the Queen ended up in an uncontrollable sort of stampede by, at times, 5,000 people an hour. So it was sort of having this sort of very calm, majestic ring set into this very beautiful landscape. We found ourselves in a completely different situation. And I think what has happened since has all been to the good of the memorial. It now has a path. The teething problems that would happen on any fountain feature, if given the chance to be found out before an opening, have been resolved. And now people use it in a completely different way than those original days. It's now used in a way that I think works very well with the park. And I'm hoping, and it may just be me, that the Royal Parks will gain courage as they see the effectiveness of the memorial, how it draws people to the site, how they like it, how they sit around it, use it. And in quite a relaxed and formal way, not the rather, non-memorial-like way that it originally received. In the Mail on Sunday, on the 21st of September, a journalist wrote, I quote, "Nothing has been in the newspapers about the Princess Diana Memorial for weeks. Maybe they've moved it or it's stolen. But I went down, it was still there, next to the Serpentine in Hyde Park. And so was Jill Stanton. She had her hot feet dangling in the rush of cold water and said, this is what people do. They go in there and bathe their feet, then splash water all over themselves, just like it was the River Jordan. And some holiness was coming through. I've seen that happen, Jill said. People become very affected. Now that's not quite how I anticipated it affecting the majority of people, but I feel that somehow, in lots of different ways, the memorial has its effect and is enjoyed and is a place for reflection. That's the end of my talk.
Rather short of
the
well,
no, short talk this week. What we'd like to do is invite two panelists up, Margaret Richardson on behalf of the Royal Academy, who was here for the Rich McCormack lecture, and Catherine Firth, who's a KPF visiting fellow on the Cities programme, to give their reaction to the scheme and to really provoke some discussion. So if you'd like to join us, and if you don't want to take the front row.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll start with Catherine.
Okay. I have to confess that the Diana Memorial has been part of my daily life since it began construction because, as many of you know, I'm a cycle commuter and lucky enough to be able to cycle through Hyde Park. So I see it as often as twice a day. So it was very interesting to watch its evolution. For me, what's incredibly interesting about the memorial is how such a simple form creates a place. We already have Hyde Park as a destination, as a place in itself that people who visit London, who live in London, have to make a point of going to, if you like. It's not the same as the neighborhood green. It's a place that, you know, you decide I'm now going to go to Hyde Park. And so it's quite interesting when within what, albeit is a rather large destination, you then start to create separate destinations. We have the Serpentine Gallery, we have the Diana Memorial Playground, and various other sort of landmarks within the park, and this then becomes part of that bigger palette, and I think that's quite interesting. What's also then sort of fascinating is how there is a kind of arbitrariness that I would say, in a sense, all of these smaller places within the big room of Hyde Park have. And in listening then to Neil talk about the topography that they were presented with and how they then, in a sense, created a topography within a topography, I think it really reinforces this idea of a series of different scale destinations. And I think that's also something that we have to remind ourselves about in the city, that we like to move between these different scales, and that's what makes a city so fascinating. I think there is still this kind of what I would call probably a pleasant randomness about the circle they've created, because it's not, you know, why is it that site? And we didn't hear much about that, but that wasn't something that you really had a lot of choice about, as I understand. It was a sort of limited choice. You weren't slightly, okay.
Not much choice.
Right. So, I mean, in a sense, it was somewhat of a given. So I think it is, again, this idea that simply by putting what in this case is, you know, a ring of stone down, where before there was grass that was, you know, completely undifferentiated from the grass that lies slightly further east or slightly further west, we now think of this as a place, and we can see from those last slides that it's very much a place. There's a kind of territorialization that's taken place. I think then for me, obviously, the element of water becomes so striking, and one wonders if it would be as much of a place if that element didn't exist. You know, we have water in the park already, but what we don't have is water that makes noise and water that's dynamic. And I think, again, that makes it into a place. And were it just a ring of stone, I would argue that it wouldn't be a place that was seen as a destination in the same way. It would be something that you would pass by, you might look at it, but you wouldn't say, I'm now going to spend time here in the same way that you do now. So I think that was something that they really, you know, that they very skillfully worked with. And then I think, you know, again, one of the things that's very striking about it is the simplicity of form, but as is so often the case, I mean, it's a bit like, you know, I was thinking of similar situations where you have something like the London Eye, which, you know, as a form is something that, by the way, as you're passing the Diana Memorial on one side, you can then see the wheel in front of you. It strikes you as a very simple form. It's a relatively simple geometric form, and yet incredibly complex to execute. And I think, for better or for worse, again, we forget that some of the simplest forms are also the most complicated. I guess the other, sort of the last thing that I'll add that is striking about it and never seems to really make it into the, with public spaces and public art and landscape, one seldom sees pictures of these places in days like we've had for the past 2 weeks or whatever it is that makes the weathermen tell us that we have murk and then more murk, a word that I didn't know before I came to this country. But even with the murk, that this kind of memorial can be beautiful. So we always see lots of you know, images of people with their feet in the water, enjoying the sunshine, kids sort of rushing about. But I think what's important to keep in mind, and this is where I do draw on my daily experience of this this place that's being created, is that even in the duller days, that it has its own life, and you know, the water is reflecting the sky, and I think that's something that is, as people either using public space, which we all do living in the city, but also, you know, as designers of public spaces, that it often gets forgotten that it's not always a bright sunny day that one's designing for. And I don't know how much the designers kept this in mind. I would argue that it was probably something you did consider hard to live here or not. But I'm sort of happy to report that I think that it has a life that works quite well through the seasons. It allows the different moods of the city, in a sense, to be then taken on by its inhabitants. But I'll stop there and pass on to you.
Okay. Well, I also think it's a really marvelous thing. I think what I like is so much is the way the water is manipulated. It's endlessly interesting as you go there. You can move around and you can just visit all these different ripples and shapes. It's like it is a sculpture, really. And so I love that. I think the thing I really like best, and I think this is where it might have influence, at least I hope it will have influence in the future, is its reticence. Because, you know, I think that the DCMS commissioned it, I think that's right, isn't it? I think it's absolutely remarkable that they picked on a design that is so reticent, particularly in the very mawkish age in which we live. Because the sentiment and mawkishness in this country at the moment is gross. And if you look at things like the Queen Mother's Memorial Gates, for example, just to take an example, but recently, if you consider the memorial to the women of the Second World War, which has gone up in Whitehall, which is the most atrocious thing in terms of its literalness and its really bad sculpture, and its need to be so explicit. To have something that is so abstract as we have with the Diana Memorial, where we can remember her for beauty, which is there, and intricacy. I don't quite go along with Neil about the business of reaching out and all that at all, because I don't think that strikes one at all. But one is struck by the great beauty of it when you go there, and the beauty of the water, so and so on. I think the way the public use it is atrocious, absolutely atrocious. I can't get over it. The slides that you, I think you were very generous to the public. I think they have shown absolutely no respect of any kind. In fact, it is actually quite difficult. I was noticing that the edges of the memorial are quite broad. It can't have been that easy to swing oneself over and sit on the edge with one's feet in the water. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous that that should have happened, happening in this country, you know. And I think, you know, we really have lost a lot here in this country, because I think that the memorial has a lot in common with the wonderful one in Washington to the dead of Vietnam in its great simplicity. It also has a lot in common with the cenotaph. And I think what is so interesting, the comparison between the two, is that the absolute simplicity of the cenotaph was welcomed by the general public and really admired at the time. Now, of course, that was the time when of great loss of life, great sadness, a recession, and a sort of wariness of rhetorical excess. And they really admired the cenotaph. And I think that's why I find that this is really brilliant that this should have happened, this memorial should have happened in our time, because it sets a standard for something which I hope will be taken up in other memorials, although I very much doubt it. Sorry, that's pessimistic.
Am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah, let's get me up and sit up.
since we've been praising you so much, I do have one question. No, but I have one question, and I also want to disagree with what was said about the way it's used. But my question is a slightly pragmatic one, which is I found it curious that there are trees which seem to be rather randomly placed within the circle, within the ring. And I was just wondering if that was a debate at all. It adds to the sense that it is random and it sort of fell from the sky, and as you described it, and I think the aerial is wonderful. I sort of think everyone would have understood it from the beginning if they had the privilege of, you know, being a bird or, you know, being able to fly over it. But I'm just curious about those trees that are dotted in the middle of it.
I think one has to see the memorial in its need to be within the park itself, and so that somehow the trees, although of course they're not mature yet, they will be, and that somehow the ring will be part of a landscape space. And we had at times thought of introducing bulbs and other plants into the context of the ring, but actually on reflection, feel happy that we've sort of actually kept it in this very stark, plain, green grass landscape. I think the trees will add shade. They will add a reference for people as they enter, a place for them eventually to sort of sit and lie in within the ring comfortably. I think if it hadn't got the trees, somehow there would have been a sort of awkwardness about placing yourself in that context. But that's my interpretation.
Sure. No, but I think it's interesting because it's very, and especially as you say, you project forward 10 years when those are fuller trees, it's a very different conception of the place to say, here's a ring, and in a sense, once you are within that ring, it's a different world than outside of that ring, which, let's face it, outside of that ring is the same palette of kind of lawn or grass and trees that don't seem that different in species from what you've introduced in the center. So, I mean, that's why I was curious about it, because I think that's
they're creating different contexts. And it's like the ring itself; it's constantly changing its form, and people will engage and sit and find their own place within that context. Some are more comfortable away from the ring, others actually, as you might not agree with, almost sort of envelop themselves with the water in the ring. So it's, you know, it's about comfort levels, I think, and also feeling your right relationship with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The trees plant.
I mean, let me spike it up a bit because everyone's being very nice. It's not a traditional response to public space or the public realm. I mean, if one looks at Trafalgar Square and what's happened with Trafalgar Square in recent times, there is a new surface, a relationship with water in a very traditional way through the Lutyens fountains and so on, and pools. And then there are sculptures that sit on plinths that are raised above the mass of people. Still, people climb all over the Lions and the base of Nelson's Column. But it's been interesting over the autumn seeing the Alison Lapper sculpture raised on high and the impact that that's had. I mean, it's been as controversial in a different way, I suppose, to what you're proposing, or have built, rather. But I was thinking about what was proposed for the Nelson Mandela statue, which went to a public inquiry in the early autumn. And that the idea there was that it would be on a lower plinth, that it would be on the north terrace of Trafalgar Square. And then again, it was encouraging people to climb over it, to be photographed in relation to it. And Westminster City Council objected to this. They objected to its position, its axiality in relation to the space, and yet in many ways it was a traditional response. It was, as Margaret was talking about, some of the other sculptures that have appeared recently, it was lifelike, it was literal in terms of its interpretation. I mean, it has to be said, I suppose, in a way that given Diana, one would expect thousands, tens of thousands of people to want to go and see this. It's in an open park setting. Very difficult to control how they approach it, whereas with Trafalgar Square, you can still control it by crossings and so on, and the circle of traffic that is around it. I mean, isn't it reasonable to propose that with something like this, and I know it wasn't part of the competition, but there should really have been a larger infrastructure which was to do with how people approach this part of the park rather than allowing it, in a sense, to be a very romantic sort of 18th century vision of parkland where people would come across the object as they might in Stourhead or Stowe or some other situation. I mean, in that sense, I was wondering how you thought about that process from the early stage.
I think given its location, it's once faced with this immediate predicament, introducing another memorial into...
Sorry, the microphone. Sorry.
I think it's a very difficult scenario to find yourself in, where you're in a park landscape, a landscape that's known for its, in a way, informality. Although, of course, it has its sort of 18th century rigor and series of features that create avenues and routes between them. To suddenly impose a much more urban form of memorial where actually you think of a new axis or a very defined piece of urban environment. It goes against the nature of the park. And I think that is sort of where the dilemma of the competition in many ways, that maybe more if people had realized that somehow, and I think in the end it's early days and not really it's true life, and that those early days were difficult days, but now it's actually working. The Royal Parks understand how to manage and supervise it. It works very well now in that context. And it's good that we didn't actually cater for that initial activity, because then it would have become inappropriate later. I think as time goes on, it's becoming appropriate. It's the right gesture for the right situation.
Okay. Jeremy.
Yes, I really just to underwrite all the things that have been said about what an extraordinarily apt proposal this is for a contemporary monument. You know, that it seems to deal with a whole series of agendas about how you can actually monumentalise in the age of the People's Princess. And I think the thinking of both Lutyens and Mayor Lim is appropriate, but also the symposium of monumentality that the Architectural Review held in 1948, where the proposal was, the underlying agenda was, how do you make a monument that deals with everyday life and not with individuals? But what actually intrigues me here is, slightly naughty, I have to say, is the relationship with the Albert Memorial. You know, and with which there is almost no connection whatsoever, except they're both memorialising people who happen to marry someone who is in direct line to the throne. And the Albert Memorial, obviously, is very specific. You have to go up steps. I don't know if anyone's ever dared to go up steps of the Albert Memorial. I certainly haven't. And, you know, you see Prince Albert sort of, you know, looking like something really rather forbidding. And all the virtues that are associated with him are memorialised there, plus their relationship to a sort of what might almost be a cosmology. But it's very specifically about Albert. I wonder if there's anything here that actually says anything about Diana, other than the fact that it's changeable and the treatment of water is perhaps ephemeral.
I th-
I said in my talk that somehow its whole form, its whole reason for being is her. I think it also works on another level. I mean, as you say, Albert's memorial is definitely for him, and you can't think otherwise. However, Diana's memorial, I think, can be taken by those who wish it to be a memorial to other reflections, other thoughts, other people, and other circumstances. But somehow, in the end, it's alluding to some similarities of existence, that how we're all affected in similar ways by some of the things she was affected by, and therefore can see, and I think that's where the bond exists between her and the rest of the British population, that actually they could see themselves in her to an extent, and that's, I think it had to be a more open relationship.
Does this have something to do with impact in that case, that by using the sort of Diana phenomenon, it's actually touching a much wider range of people than Prince Albert's memorial did, which you really have to see.
I would like to think that there is an impact, and I would like to think that 100 years from now, when maybe her presence is less, that people who do visit that site actually have some of the feelings they have now, you know, without really knowing too much about her, that it somehow gains a response that's more emotional than knowing.
I think Catherine wanted to respond to that, and then I'll open up to the...
Not really a response, but I think it's perhaps contributing a little bit to Jeremy's comment. What I think is fascinating is that the actual sort of memorial or individuals' memorials, i.e., bouquets of flowers and photographs of Diana, don't seem to get placed at your memorial on her birthday, but rather still get hung on the gates of Kensington Gardens. And I mean, I'm not arguing, I'm not disputing, you know, your last statement about it being a memorial that sort of goes beyond an individual, and I think people will make their own interpretations, but. You know, as I said, I think it is fascinating that there's a separate place which somehow in itself has become immemorialized as the place that if you're going to actually pay homage, it's not so much about putting your feet in the water, but you're going to go to this other location with its own iconographic significance and hang the flowers there.
Okay.
This is about the public dipping their feet in the water. The thing is, public art has the potential to do something beyond the program, as in really make an impact on the city at large, and over and above the program of just being a memorial to Diana. And in this case, I think the minimalism of the design gesture that's been made and the very simple tactile activity of dipping your feet in the water is, it's allowed people to be flexible about it. And I think it's beautiful how all sorts of different people come to this place and sit together maybe and see each other, acknowledge each other's presence, and realize how diverse we really are in London right now. And I think it should be seen as a measure of the success of the project instead of how people are disrespecting Diana, whatever.
That's a compliment. Let's have a question.
Well, basically, it was the same thing.
Okay. There's a gentleman here. Okay. Yeah.
Could you just elaborate a little bit more on your working process? That seemed really interesting with the clay models, and perhaps how the later processes with the computer work has influenced, or is going to be influencing your work in the future.
The clay model is Catherine's medium introduced to the London office, and something that takes a while to really grapple with. Its malleability and it sometimes just doesn't do what you want it to do. It takes a while to master. However, it's the best way to feel the surface and actually understand what spatial form you can create out of a very subtle medium, the ground plane. As an architect, I'm obviously trained to think with much harder three-dimensional forms, and it's amazing how much you can suggest by just subtle movement in the ground once you've studied it. And I think that's the problem. You don't see it until you do it. The process of developing a landscaped space from clay has always been the process by which Catherine's worked, and I think it's interesting that you see very few people work in that way in landscape, and surprisingly so. How that then becomes a computer-generated piece of information that builders build from and that depict the landscape in a two-dimensional form is also very interesting and something that we've worked on for a long time. I mean, my first experience of it was working on the Botanic Garden of Wales, where we literally used a scanner to take the three-dimensional form of the clay model, turn it into digital information that we then simply use to cut sections and create the technical drawings directly. And it's remarkably a natural process. You'd think a computer screen would sort of be rather restraining, especially on a surface that is sort of very broad and wide and almost endless. The Diana Memorial, I think it was more interesting from the way that we then took that scanning process on and actually saw a way to almost not do any drawings at all, that you could actually take the digital information and put it into machinery and get results that could be built from without drawings. And that I doubt it's achievable architecturally in buildings, but certainly when you're creating sculpture and landscape form, there's, I think, a really interesting precedent here that might evolve in future work.
Maybe there's a coming together of some technologies that's going to have real benefits in the future for designers much further than
landscape
designers.
I mean, as you say, the car industry is already very fluent with the language and understands how it can use the technology to its advantage. But there are areas of industry, like the stone masonry industry, that has, you know, just not understood what they have available to them. If you mean were there any surveys or sort of, quite understanding the question. No, we'd never expected it to be static and serene. Although, actually, you know, there are different aspects to it. I think, seen from a distance, from a long way off, it is the sort of static ring that draws your eye to it. The whiteness of the stone is important. The fact that it could be seen as a very abstract form in the landscape was important as the draw to it. However, obviously, having got people there, you want them to engage. We obviously created a whole series of different water effects, but knew that people would want to either sit beside it, as they do sit with their feet in it. It was generally an intuitive response about how we feel people would use that space as an environment.
Is it chair at the back?
Hi. How did your client actually react and respond to the bad publicity that you received immediately? Had they anticipated that and were they able to sort of put things into motion quickly to respond to that, or did it catch them completely unaware?
Obviously, in the early days, everybody was very responsive to the dilemmas of having open to that number of people. And, of course, it closed down. I mean, everybody knows that. It was well publicised. And it was, obviously, with much regret. I mean, nobody wanted that to happen, but simply the right safeguards hadn't been put in place. And they needed to get that right.
Was it quite a panic, or did they suddenly have, you know, right, okay, we'll do this? They had like a PR plan to roll out and almost, you know, protect your reputation, as it were.
We were pretty well left to our own devices on that one.
Yes, gentlemen. Even though I think it's a lovely result you got up there, I disagree with a few things about the way it's been created. So I want to find out how much you looked into depth on Diana's personality, and if this was just your interpretation or your inspiration of what you thought that people perceive what was left of her memory. I didn't anticipate the use of the memorial and how it's going to be perceived by the people. I thought it was like an accident or something.
It wasn't an accident at all. I think the issue of how closely does the abstract form of a ring and water that flows through it personify a real person and a life was not really our... I think there's been a lot of sort of rather difficult stories in the press about how the bubbling brook was this passage of her life, and then the effervescent water is the next passage, and it was never meant to be such a framed reference to periods of her life at all. I think it was simply ultimately the overall concept that we felt, and I think Catherine disagreed, but the idea that somehow the ring, the fact that people were drawn to it, was a very beautiful object. It had extreme elegance, all qualities that she had, would be seen as the relationship. And that the aspects of water, which of course can be drawn as a sort of a parallel in some ways to a life, and how water can change as it passes through a surface and erodes that surface. You can draw the parallels, but you can never make them instances of a life. It doesn't make sense.
Can I quickly find out how long did you spend of your time management of investigating what Diana is or was for the people, and how people would like to see her on the memorial?
It's interesting. Catherine with, I'm speaking for Catherine here, she can put me right, with a not such a good knowledge of the person, and I have the knowledge of her through being brought up in this country. She was on television almost every day. She was in the papers almost every day. So you build a background that way of a life. Whereas Catherine actually took away books and read about her. And actually it was Catherine who came up with the concept that we then built on as a sort of a form. I mean, the Albert Moore is rather interesting, almost contrast to the memorial itself, where in a way his life and thoughts and theories are depicted very clearly as pieces of sculptural form and text around the perimeter of statue of the man himself. I think that was the correct thing for that age. We believed it had to be different for now.
Thanks.
Okay. So the last question, I think, at the front here.
I think it's a wonderful compliment to you that people have made this their own. It's become... Londoners obviously love it. And it's appropriate to Princess Diana, because she was known as the people's princess, after all. I was distressed at first that John couldn't paddle in it. Can they use it now?
Paddling, no. But there's no reason why they can't engage with it. They can play.
How can they engage if they can't paddle?
Children are extremely inventive. yeah. I mean, they can play. They can sit beside it. They can enjoy the water.
I will. The very, very last question.
I recently visited Spain and noticed that many of the fountains in the city were not working because of the shortage of water. So my question has to do with the environmental impact of these fountains, and what is the position of your team if you consider it, that is relevant to continue designing features that had water, has use of water in times where water is actually...
Water is a valuable resource that we shouldn't waste. I know. I understand the context of the question. The Diana Memorials had a very interesting water strategy developed around issues that existed in the park itself. The Serpentine is a rather stagnant body of water that actually requires some fresh oxygenated water to run through it. The memorial in part helps with that process. We sunk a borehole that brings water from the groundwater table up into the memorial, where it passes through the surface of the memorial, gets oxygenated, and then moves into the Serpentine itself. I can't remember the exact technical issues associated with the number of cycles the water goes through before entering the Serpentine, but it helps, hopefully, in the summer with some of the problems of algal bloom that occur there at the moment. And the water table, in fact, in London, through the lack of industry, is rising. And so all the water authorities are encouraging people to use that rising water table to help create less problems with cellars and basements and buildings.
Okay, thank you. I think we should thank you very much for demythologizing
the Diana Memorial, which will no doubt allow people to apply more and more myths to it now that we've got this blank sheet. But impact was the theme of this lecture. The next lecture on the 16th of February is on Stratford City at a very different scale. But meanwhile, Neil Porter, thank you very much. And Catherine and Margaret.